in West Africa started in March of 2014. Before that, it's not that they didn't have cases. They had cases, but people were not so aware. Definitely the Western countries were not so aware. So the numbers were probably not reported. So in March, around March, April, when things started to escalate and our countries did not want the infection to travel to US and to Europe, is when world started to notice and everybody went in West Africa to contain it. So CDC was there, WHO has always been in Africa, they just always are. And there were a bunch of other organizations. When we were there, it almost felt like everybody was there. There was UNICEF, there was UK Aid, China Aid. I'd never heard of China Aid before. Patient First was running emergency clinics there. There were doctors from Cuba who were helping with the Ebola patients. And then Doctors Without Borders have been managing this from the very beginning. So they were there. So some of the things that the African government put in place that really helped in control. Because most, and I'm not sure how many of you know how Africa is. It's pretty rural. The literacy rate is very low. Sanitation is a huge problem. So basic things like hand washing and keeping your, you know, the area around your house clean and stuff is not that common. So what we noticed there when we went there first time, that there was a huge campaign on part of the government to control garbage. You know, because that's the breeding ground. So there were billboards. There was mandatory hand washing. So when you travel from district to district, every half an hour, they make you get out of your car, you wash your hands, then they check your temperature, and then you move on. So this is to prevent the travel of the virus. And this applies to everybody. People who are traveling in bus, taxi, car, and on foot. There are not many roads, so there's only one road that connects one district to another. So that was their control mechanism. Any hotel you went to, you wash your hands, they check your temperature, then you go in. So that was their control mechanism. If your temperature is high, don't get out of the hotel. That was the Westerner's approach. So if you got a little bit of a viral going on, you don't want to be in the hospital because you do not have an option. If your temperature is high, they will take you to the hospital because it is an infectious disease. And isolation is the key. So you don't think that you have the right to do this and that. There are no rights at that point. So after about 2 years, on January 14, 2016, is when WHO declared that West Africa was free of Ebola virus. Now, that doesn't mean that it has been eradicated. It still exists. It's just not an epidemic anymore. There have been cases reported after January, one or two here and there, but it's not like in the hundreds. Okay. So this is the map of the three countries that saw the worst of it. And they're all Western African countries. It's Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. It's essentially how many cases. The darker, the more cases they saw. And you can see Sierra Leone is off the coast. It's got couple of regions that are really high, one fairly clean, and then other ones fairly moderate. This trial was primarily done in Sierra Leone only, sponsored by CDC, and in collaboration with a whole variety of organizations and people. Okay, so this slide gives you an idea of how many cases were reported during the two-year period. About 28,000. And the three lines are for three countries. There's Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And Sierra Leone had the most number of cases. And like I said, the reporting started in March, so whatever happened before it, we don't know. And even during that initial period, people were not that well aware, so a lot of the cases probably went unreported. Keep in mind that the fatality rate in this disease is a little under 50%. And it's very quick. It doesn't give you a lot of time. One day you have fever, the second day you're going to be throwing up, the third day your organs start to die. So, and it's highly infectious with the fluids that the patient. So whoever is the caregiver is going to be most at risk. And that's how it got families. Because mostly if one person gets sick, a family member will take care of them, they'll get it, and the third, then the fourth, and it's just devastating. So the background on the trial, what was the design of this study? This vaccine that we are testing, and the trial is still going on, it plans to end sometime at the end of this year. This is a single dose vaccine, so one shot, no boosters, with two arms. One is immediate vaccination. When the subject comes in, you can call it a volunteer or a subject who is going to participate in the trial. If they meet eligibility, they can be vaccinated the same day. And the second group is the deferred vaccination, is the control group, who we will follow for 6 months for all events of their life. However, they're not vaccinated. So you want to see the difference between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. The goal was to enroll about 6,000 voluntary healthy individuals working in healthcare facilities or on the frontline activities. Because the healthcare caregiver is the most at risk. So that was the goal, to vaccinate those people first. And then the frontline workers are the grave diggers and, you know, people who handle the dead bodies and things like that. And they enrolled about 6,200 people. So there was plenty of response. There were about 7 to 8 clinical sites in different districts. So that was the reason we traveled from one district to another district to visit all the sites, which is kind of interesting. And the goal is to determine the safety of the vaccine and its efficacy. So it has to be proven safe to use. It can't kill more people than the virus. And it should be effective, right? I mean, it can't just give you something else that you're going to die from. So that's one of the goals, always in a clinical trial. So today's presentation is, I'm not going into technical details of the trial. Today's presentation is more about the challenges, the compliance challenges in a country like Sierra Leone. It was their first ever clinical trial. They have never done a clinical trial before. So for them to get it off the ground, actually conduct it, and to reach where they are, it's kind of amazing. So one of the challenges is immigrant facilities. Sierra Leone is one of those old countries, brick and cement buildings. Window and door is all you have. And the windows have the metallic railing to prevent theft, because that's their main concern. In poor countries, we don't have screen doors. We have iron railings on our windows, and the screen door is of iron railing to prevent theft. So in case of a fire, you only have one door to go out. So that's one of the challenges. One of the challenges is this vaccine has to be stored at minus 80 degrees C centigrade. The whole country did not have a single minus 80 degrees centigrade freezer. They had never seen one. So they were shipped from US. They were shipped, validated, and then the drug was shipped after. Then, okay, you got the freezer. You shipped the freezer from US. It has to be powered continuously, 24 hours a day. Most of the sites are not on the power grid. Even if they are, the power is not 24-hour supply. So you have to ship the generators with them. And if your site is on the power grid, you're going to need one generator. If your site is not on a power grid at all, then you need two generators, one as primary, one as backup. And then public transportation, like I said, there's one road from one district to another district. However, once you go inside the district, it's a give or take, road or half a dirt road or nothing. So to move drug or the study charts or anything else that you want to move from one site to another site, you have to take complete responsibility of it. You cannot courier them or, you know, call the hotel. There's no such thing. So you have to make arrangements for everything. So that's why, you know, as an auditor, it's easy for me to say, oh, no, you didn't do this and you didn't do that. However, when you look at the operations, you think you couldn't do that. It's amazing what they did. Staff recruitment. That was another challenge. It's the first clinical trial in Sierra Leone, so no one actually has done a trial or has had GCP or E6 training or knowledge. So all the PIs, all the study physicians, nurses, staff who enrolled patients, clerk to checkout clerk. I think CDC trained everybody, even the cleaning people. They just did not want to take a chance. So there was a massive training program. We have webinars. We had a training module, which is online on intake and retake if they want to consult that. And then they had the face-to-face training sessions. So there was a massive effort to get people to train on the daily requirements. The country does have a regulatory authority. It's in their pharmacy board. They regulate the export and import of the drug and things like that. They're not really that good with the clinical trial regulations. They kind of just leave it to FDA and EMA to their rags. So, subject recruitment. So in the beginning, the recruitment was really low. They couldn't get people to volunteer, because you do have to volunteer for a clinical trial, and it is in healthy subjects. this trial was not meant to be in sick population. And media campaign wouldn't be that effective since most of the country is not on the power grid, so people don't actually watch TV in the evening every day over there. You know, so there's no such things. They do have radio. They listen to BBC radio, I noticed a lot over there. This is an English-speaking country because they were colonized by the British. So they do speak fairly good amount of English, so which is good. So what CDC did was they held workshops at healthcare facilities, multiple workshops to make people aware of the trial so they could recruit people to come and get vaccinated on their sites. When we were on site and we saw multiple subjects being enrolled, and you know, it's about a 4-hour process to go through the informed consent, let them know everything about the trial. They have the opportunity to ask questions. Most of the time you see either people come mentally prepared, thinking that once they get vaccinated, they're good to go. They will not get Ebola. So it takes a lot of time to explain to them that this is not a proven vaccine. We don't know what's going to happen. So you kind of see the damper on their face at that time, but you know, they get paid for that time that they spend. So, which is good, they still stay and they listen to the whole thing. And then there was a lot of notion around that it's a live vaccine, it's live Ebola virus in the vaccine, although it's not, but you know, people always think that it's a scam to just get everybody out. So that was another challenge. You know, they're just trying to eradicate our tribe because they have tribes in that country. So they actually, one of the site manager was the prince of one of the tribes. To build confidence in people, they employed like the high-ranking officials of the tribes to work with them for the trial. So that worked. Lack of understanding of the clinical trial processes. It is a poor country, you know, so sometimes people think, okay, I'm gonna get paid for 4 hours. I'm gonna go through that process, not get vaccinated, get paid, and be on my way, right? So we saw that a lot. People would go through the whole process and then they go, I want to think about it. I don't want to get vaccinated today. So that was a challenge. And then once you get vaccinated, each subject is followed for 6 months to see if there's any adverse event, if there's any change in their condition, working condition, or they get infected or not get infected or any other issues they're having. So every month, the surveillance team calls them and goes through this checklist. And that was a challenge because people didn't feel responsible that they have to actually do that, to be followed for 6 months. They're like, we got the vaccine, we're good. That's it, now you do whatever. So subject follow-up, that was a big challenge. We saw a lot of subjects lost to follow-up. CDC issued a cell phone to each participant or subject, so they could call them on that cell phone, or they could call, the subject could call the data center as well if they're experiencing any issue or they need an ambulance, you know, for any reason. But they're just not used to keeping that phone around, having it charged all the time. You know, in Western countries, I mean, we're glued to our phones, or our phone is glued to us. You don't see that. For them, charging it every day was a hassle. So even though they got a free phone, it has a SIM card in it, it's gonna ring when CDC wants to call you, but it has to be charged. So that was another challenge. So explaining and a lot of explaining of procedures, just re-explaining at every follow-up is difficult. I mean, sometimes they call these people five times, and then they would actually, they had a team that would go to their village and find them and do the face-to-face follow-up. And finding's not easy. They don't have road names or apartment numbers or house numbers. It goes to the village name. That's it. There are districts, junctions, and village. After the village, you ask around who you're looking for, you know. I mean, we saw so many subject files that would say, this village, how do I find you? So one of the questions CDC had on the contact information sheet is, how do I find you in your village? And it would say, there's a mango tree by my house. And if you drive from district to district, there are mango trees everywhere. Everywhere. I mean, the mangoes are just hanging to the ground to be picked up. And I'm going, so how?
Which mango tree?
Which mango tree? And one said, I'm very popular in my village. So just ask. So, I mean, it can be very challenging, but they did figure out a way. They had two additional contacts for each subject, you know, cousin, friend, mother, father, somebody. So they can, if they don't find them, they'll find somebody else, and then they'll find them. And then they had a whole team of people who all they did was go to these villages and find people. So you can imagine 6,000 of them. So it's a massive undertaking. So this was funny. I guess this was funny for us, going from being a U.S. auditor, credential verification. But it was normal for them. They didn't think anything of them at all. So all of the study personnel, that was the local study personnel, people from CDC stayed there, and they had a bunch of contractors who did the monitoring and other things. But the local personnel were from either the government employees, they worked for the Sierra Leone government, or the medical school in Freetown, it's called COMAS. They were students at the medical school or employees at the medical school. So those people were recruited by the government of Sierra Leone to help with the study. So they ran the vaccinators, the study nurses, even the physicians, they were all from COMAS. They did not feel that they have to have their license submitted to anyone, because they already worked for the government or the university, so their credentials were proven. But see, for a clinical trial, you have to have those in the trial master file for any inspecting agency. So when we asked for them, it was, they first were quite like, I don't, initially they found it insulting that we asked. You know, so they've looked at you like, you know, I don't know. After a couple of times, they got used to the idea. Then they said, but we don't need to submit them to CDC. It's in our files somewhere. So anyways, after a lot of discussion, by the time we went second time around, they came down to, they had CVs. Nurses all had nursing licenses. Physicians did not. And there's a funny reason for that. In Sierra Leone, if you are a physician, once you graduate, you can continue to practice for however long you want. You can or cannot renew the license. It's not mandatory because no one's really asking for it. But if you do file for renewal, it costs you $500,000 leonis every year. So if I'm a physician, I don't need to produce it. You know, why spend $500,000 leonis every year for something, a piece of paper that I don't usually need? And for clinical trial, you need it. Now, all these physicians have been practicing for 20, 25 years. And so they're like, if we apply it now, the government is going to want all that money back for all those years. I don't want to do it. So they're still dancing around that subject. It's like, who is going to pay? Somebody needs to pay, obviously. So, but they're working on it. So, standardization of services, I mean, it's a very mom and pop shop type of country. There are no big chains, no standardized hotels, restaurants, or supermarkets, or things like that. It's very much up to the individual owner, what they want to sell, how they want to sell, what quality. So it was difficult. So all the trial-related supplies were shipped from US. We visited a laboratory in the Bo district, and that laboratory was set up by CDC to perform PCR testing to detect Ebola virus in suspected patients. And when I first saw the SOP before I went to Africa, and I'm going, oh, I want to audit this, there is no way that they have all of these things that are written in here. But CDC set up shop with CDC employees only in a house that had four rooms to separate out, you know, the RNA extraction room, the clean room, things that you would need for a PCR laboratory. And the dumping ground of the waste is the nearby landfill, because there's no underground sanitation. So they would neutralize their waste on a daily basis, liquid and solid. After they neutralized, after 24 hours, they would dump it in the nearest landfill. That's all they could do. So, but while we were there, some of the things we saw, Saturday morning every week till 10 o'clock, everything would be closed. No services available because the government ordered the spray, the insecticide and pesticide spray off the entire country so that they could kill the infections. So there were a lot of efforts on part of the world and on part of the governments to actually control this disease. It's still just controlled. It's there, it's still there, but it's just not an epidemic. And that's why this trial is still going on. They will submit to FDA sometime next year to get it approved and to stockpile the vaccine in case there is another epidemic. Just a little bit about TRI experience. We have a QA department, a QA team. We currently have 12 auditors, and they're all well, 80% are CQA certified. We have a couple of new ones who are probably going to sit in the next one. And we audit different kinds of things, mostly clinical, so laboratories, investigator sites, manufacturing facilities, things like that. And they've had the opportunity working with the government, mostly NIH, to travel to some strange places wherever the government takes us over the years, and Sierra Leone was one of them. And because our largest contract is with NIAID, which is the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. So we tend to do more infectious diseases trials than anything else. Okay. So some fun facts. We saw locals had made plaques for the tourists, which were mostly aid people there, with CDC and WHO response teams to Ebola. So we thought it would be fun to bring it back for our CEO. She got a chuckle out of it. Smoking is permitted in public places. You can pretty much smoke anywhere. There's no regulation. This was surprising to me first time when I went there. There is a significant amount of Lebanese population in Sierra Leone. They pretty much own all the stores there, hardware stores and, you know, general stores, everything. You'll always see a Lebanese person in there. They're very good business people, and they've kind of established a very good chain there. So their food, hummus, pita, and shawarma, is like Sierra Leonean food over there. You can get it anywhere, and it's good. So you can live off of that. It's good. And then Muhammad is the most popular name. Out of the three drivers in 3 weeks, two were Muhammad. So, and you know, almost half of the subjects were Muhammad. So it's a very popular name. The country is about half Christian, half Islamic. So Muhammad seems to rhyme with everything. And then I have some pictures. This is just one of the pictures we took on the roadside. It's outside of the towns, you know, typical residential places, dirt roads, and beat up homes. Okay. So this is an example of a hand washing station. If you, I don't know how clear this is. But this is a UNICEF tent, and this is where you would wash your hands. There's a tank behind it, if you can see it. And then inside the shed, they check your temperature. It's one of those digital thermometers. They just point it to you, and it tells you the temperature. As long as it's normal within a certain range, they just let you go. And then you move on, get in your car, and drive off to wherever you're headed. But this is every half an hour. So if you're going from Freetown to Bo, which is 4 hours, you get off about 8 to 9 times.
Yes,
4 hours in a car. There's not much public transportation, so it's not like you could take a train or a bus. It's pretty much you hire a car and a car service if you're going there, and they'll drive you around. This is one of the Ebola treatment centers in Bo. This picture is from Bo as well. So these tents are what was put up by the Doctors Without Borders organization, and they've been keeping the Ebola patients. If you are confirmed Ebola case, this is where you go, and they treat you there. And this is sort of like an isolated compound. You can't really come out until the doctors, you know, clear you. It looks pretty sad from outside, but it's a rather large facility. You can only take the picture from the front because they don't really let you in. But the ambulance brings the patients around here, and then they take them in. Now, next. And this is a close-up picture. This is as close as you can get to the Ebola treatment center. So. Question. Oh, this is one of the roadside markets. So everything is pretty much done on the road. You can buy anything. Road vendors are extremely popular, and you can buy pretty much everything on the road. So it's very interesting. Sodas to moonshine to whatever you want. You can exchange money right on the road. The guy just comes to you with the bag. No, literally, he comes to you with the bag, you give him the dollars, he gives you the leones. Questions.
Before you ask the question, let me hand you the microphone. So, Bruce, since you're so gung-ho, you get to be the first person.
Other than bushmeat in general, have they identified a host repository of Ebola yet, an agreed one?
Not that I know of. There is a very interesting chimpanzee reserve over there in Freetown, a little away from Freetown, where they bring in the orphan chimpanzees and they protect them in the reserve. So that was interesting as well.
Given this area, was there any involvement on developing the vaccine from here? We've got Fort Detrick up in Frederick, just across the street at Fort Belvoir, and out in Reston, there were some Ebola studies that were going on that I read about when I first moved here, which made me think a couple of times since I'd just seen the movie Outbreak.
So I'm not sure where the phase one was done for this vaccine, because they did do a phase one trial before. This is a phase two, which is done in the country where the epidemic is. Phase ones are usually done on healthy volunteers in US, Europe, because it's easy and it's close. So there were a whole bunch of phase one trials done. I audited one in London myself, but this was not that vaccine. So which one of them progressed, I'm not sure where the phase one was for this. It could be Fort Detrick, because BARDA is also involved in this trial. So it's like CDC, BARDA, and then eHealth, and a bunch of contractors. So it could very well be that.
Yeah, hang on, Chris.
How long do they get an immunity, and is it a temporary immunity? Like, you know, after you've had a cold, you're good for about 2 weeks before getting the same?
So there is a belief in Sierra Leone that if you're a survivor, then you can be the caregiver for an Ebola patient. It has not been proven. And one of the challenges was that if you didn't really go through a laboratory-confirmed Ebola, you got sick, but you never confirmed it by PCR testing or anything, you start to think that you're an Ebola survivor, but you may or may not be. And that was one of the challenges. And because the disease and the government campaign, people start to celebrate the Ebola survivors. So if you got sick, you got better, but you did not actually got Ebola, but the town or the village you were in thought so, you were celebrated as a survivor and expected to be the caregiver of another Ebola patient. So that got really tricky. So they were discouraging people, even the survivors, to not be the primary caregivers of Ebola patients. One, it's not proven, and two, we don't even know if you're a true survivor or not. So that was one of the challenges. They would just encourage people to go to the Ebola treatment center and not be the local caregiver if you're a survivor. But, I mean, a lot of people think that, but it's never been proven.
I think Sierra Leone is famous for diamond, is that correct?
Yeah, they have diamond
because
mines.
That Blood Diamond movie was made there. So did you buy any diamonds here?
They're not that. They have the diamond mines. A colleague of mine who went with me, he was very interested in, you know, the diamond miners, like what do they look like? And so every time he thought somebody looked like a diamond miner, he's like, that's a diamond miner. That's a diamond miner right there. Okay. But we didn't see any. But they do, Sierra Leone is known for their diamond mines.
For U.S. citizens who came back to the United States, and this is going back into last summer and the previous year, missionaries, healthcare workers, in the famous cases in Dallas, Atlanta, New Jersey, did they receive this vaccine or a different one?
No, they did not. The U.S. citizens who came back here were treated in Emory or NIH facility, or there was one case in Dallas. They were using experimental cocktails of antibiotics, mostly. Because this vaccine was not even in this shape at that time. They were still in phase one. And I don't think they will ever disclose their treatment. They probably used a whole bunch of things. Who knows? Because it's all experimental. Nothing is proven yet.
What was going on with the Ebola virus before 2014? Why was the rate of cases so low and then started to climb? Has the virus increased in virulence, or is it just because it's reaching more of a critical mass and there are more infected people who are able to pass their infection on to others?
I don't know for sure, but from what we heard there was that it started with one of the tribes being infected, a couple of people being infected, and then it just took off from there. A lot of it is not knowing your disease. Mm-hmm. Because if you get a fever and you're throwing up, most of the time people get that with malaria over there. You know, it's highly common. Malaria, people just get it a couple of times in their lifetime. So if you just get a fever, start throwing up, somebody takes care of you, and it's so fast. The spread is so fast that they just did not see it coming. And then there's a lot of belief in the voodoo things and the herbalists and things like that. I mean, we saw a couple of cases during the subject review files. Somebody would have malaria or something. They took her to the hospital. There was this 25-year-old woman. They took her to the hospital. And the next day, the husband took her to the herbalist. And she died because of the belief system. You know, in their mind, they were doing the right thing, but not knowing hurt them a lot more. So I'm not sure why it took off. It's probably sanitation problem. If you look at the country, you'd say, anything will grow here. It doesn't matter. Because it's by the coast, it's humid, it's green, and then the trash is everywhere. So, I mean, does it matter if it's Ebola? We can control Ebola now, it'll be something else tomorrow if you don't build proper sanitation system.
I had heard that the most recent outbreak spread wider and faster because the mortality rate was not as high. In the earlier versions, it was probably killing off its hosts too quickly, and so it wasn't able to spread.
Yeah.
Is that it's approximately
possible.
True?
Because it's infectious. Once you get it, it's infectious for 21 days. So if you get exposed to an Ebola patient today, and the virus is in you, you don't have to get sick today. It stays in you for 21 days, and it has the capability to get you on the 21st day.
But you had mentioned mortality was a little below 50%, mm-hmm. and I had heard earlier versions were somewhere up around 80-85%.
No, I don't think that's high. Yeah, but probably in the earlier, when they did not have the Ebola treatment centers, I'm sure it was higher. Because people didn't know how to treat it. You know, when we came back the first time, that was last summer, we had to report our body temperature twice a day to the health department for 21 days. But when we came back this March, because the epidemic is done, we didn't have to report it. Now they just want you to report it if your fever's high. If you feel you have a fever within 21 days, you report it. But the first time, normal, abnormal, everything has to be reported.
As an auditor, what are some of your takeaways from this?
Well, one of my biggest takeaways is the cultural differences. You know, it's easy to say, okay, we're going to do a trial in a country that has never done a trial. We can train everybody, no problem. We'll take trainers, we'll train everybody. But one of the biggest things I saw is when we train people, we usually tell them what to do. We don't tell them the consequence of what happens when they don't do it. So I saw a lot of local staff not following their training because they did not get that concept of why it was important what they were doing. Like they had one staff for the monthly follow-ups, there are like 25 questions on that checklist. And they're supposed to ask those questions to the subject, right? And one of the staff would call for the follow-up and go, how's it going, is everything good? Good? All right, and fill the checklist. And because they monitor these calls, they're like, how can the checklist be full in like 2 seconds, right? So we saw a lot of pitfalls of, although you do extensive training, but because people don't understand the consequences, they try to take shortcuts. So if you're going to train somebody on something new, include the consequences of not doing it so they understand why they have to do it.
Well, it really adds credence to the pathology and bacteriology mm-hmm. classes where a professor will quip, and the bacteria shall inherit the earth and rule it. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
You know, pharmaceutical companies and, you know, the food companies. When you go to these places, your expectations are different.
Yeah.
I go here, I expect certain way. Mm-hmm. But when you go there, you may not expect the same things.
Right. And we went mentally prepared. I mean, you know, that this is not a U.S. site. You're not going to have everything in place. So the goal was to see what is critical for the approval of the vaccine. So there's a lot of gray area in that. FDA will accept a lot of the, you know, things that in US it's expected. But you look for the critical things. As long as you can have these in place by the end of the trial, you know, the chances of the vaccine getting approved are high. So you focus on those things.
Seema, thank you very, very much for some out-of-this-world insights into compliance, working in different cultures and totally foreign environments than what we're used to here in the United States. So thank you very much, and thank you for the good work you're bringing to live people who need the help.
Thank you.